This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Underneath the cow patties in the pasture and the monkey dung in the jungle, there's a miniature world of sex and violence. Dung beetles with fierce-looking horns are battling over female beetles. And my guest, Douglas Emlyn, is studying them. He's an expert on the evolution and development of bizarre or extreme shapes in insects. He's particularly interested in insect weaponry. Dung beetles have what he's looking for. Lots of Emlyn's work is in the lab, but he's also had some wild adventures collecting different families of dung beetles from around the world. Emlyn is a professor of biology at the University of Montana. If you want to follow along, on our website there's a dung beetle slideshow and a video of two beetles battling. That's at freshair.npr.org. Doug Emlyn, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, I think it's fair to say that dung beetles wouldn't be most people's first choice of an animal to study. So what is unique about the dung beetle's armor that makes you so interested in studying them?
There are a variety of things, and I guess I should first of all qualify that by saying they weren't my first choice of organism either. It's a hard thing to wake up in the morning and decide you're suddenly going to go out there and study dung beetles. I started out trying to study some of the big rhinoceros beetles as a graduate student, and the project failed pretty spectacularly, and it was a biologist named Bill Eberhard that took me under his wing after that failed project and said, no, you're looking at the wrong beetles. And he opened up this box, and it was full of all these little tiny beetles that are the size of your pinky or even the size of an eraser on a new pencil. And he opens up the box, and it smells like horse manure. And I looked at him, and I said, those are dung beetles. There's no way I'm going to work on those things. And he laughed at me at the time and told me I was a fool and basically explained that for all the kinds of biology that I wanted to understand, genetics and behavior and diversity, these things were perfect. And since that time, to come back full circle to your question, the dung beetles have turned out to be an amazing system to study, and they've taught us so much about biology in many ways. But you mentioned the weapons. The thing that first drew me to them is the spectacular diversity in their morphology. They have these incredible shapes, and most of the diversity in those shapes involves these weapons. And so, for lack of a better analogy, these tiny little insects that, again, as I said, are often the size of an eraser on a pencil and a new pencil, these things are the insect equivalent of a bull elk or a major male deer. And they have incredible weapons coming off of their bodies. And you look across the species, and there's variation among the species. Sometimes the horns come from the back of the head, sometimes from the front of the head, sometimes from the thorax, which is equivalent to sort of between your shoulder blades. Sometimes they're branched, forked, curved, straight. There's just an incredible variety of forms. And I was interested as a biologist in how a little tiny animal like that could strut around with these enormous weapons sticking off the side of their body and survive.
Yeah, well, it's kind of amazing. And, I mean, not only do they have these weapons, like some of them are like antlers, some of them are like a rhinoceros horn, some of them are like lobster pincers, but they also have like hair.
Many of the horns, you mean the beetles or the horns?
Well, the beetles, and yeah.
They do, and some of the horns in some of the species tend to have hair. We see that more often in the rhinoceros beetles than in the dung beetles per se, but very often the sides of these horns are adorned with thick rows of hairs. And it's really sort of embarrassingly unknown what those things do. There's a good chance that they are sensory structures so that when a male locks with another male fighting, they can tell where the horns of the opponent male are because they're distending or pushing down all these fine hairs on the surface of the horn. But some people think that the hairs might actually have chemodetectors. They may be good for smell or for releasing signals. We don't know.
I can tell you one thing for sure. They're not fashionable. Okay. They're really creepy looking.
That's a matter of opinion. I disagree. I think they're fantastic.
Well, they are fantastic in a creepy kind of way. Let me ask you to describe one or two of the types of dung beetles that you find most fascinating in terms of their form and shape.
Sure. So one of the species of dung beetle that we've spent quite a bit of time studying has the species name Taurus, as in the bull, and it actually has a pair of long curved horns that extend upwards and backwards from the head of male beetles. So it's a big curled set of horns, and when the head is tucked back against the rest of the body, the horns sort of wrap in snugly around the equivalent of the shoulders or the thorax. But when these males are fighting, they pull their heads forward, and they've got quite an impressive pair of horns. And we've looked at these beetles in a variety of ways and looked at what they do with the horns and who has the horns and who doesn't have the horns and how the horns develop and all kinds of questions coming from that basic oddity of their morphology, the fact that they've got these huge weapons.
You want to describe another one?
Sure. So one of my favorite species, unfortunately, it's not one that we've been able to study in numbers, but it's one of the most spectacular of these beetles, is a species that actually was illustrated in Darwin's book, his treatise, in which he initially described the whole theoretical concept of sexual selection, the process of biology that myself and so many other biologists study. And in this beetle, the beetle is a brilliant, iridescent green color, turning sort of shimmering from a green to a yellow to a blue, and in some angles even purple. So it has this beautiful sheen to it. And the males have a long, curved pair of horns that come up from the head that are much longer than the ones in the species I just described to you. And they have a branch in the middle of them with a tine that comes off and points inwards. And then at the very tips of the horns, it swells outwards into almost a little plate. So beautiful, branched, curved horns coming off of this species.
So the purpose of these weapons, you know, the horns and the pincers, are basically to fight off other guys for girls. It's like the male dung beetles fight each other over the available female beetles.
They do.
Have you watched them fight?
Oh, yes. Yes, many times.
Oh, describe what a fight looks like.
That actually looks like pandemonium. It was not what we expected at all. So these are dung beetles, the ones that we're talking about right now. And so what happens in these cases is these beetles are very good at smelling their food source, and they follow these odor cues into the food. And when they find dung of the particular species that they feed on, they often have to deal with hundreds and in some cases thousands of other individuals that are coming in and piling into that same place and basically competing to carve up and use that food resource. So what happens is the beetles go instantly underground. They go right beneath the food source, the dung pile, so to speak, and the females actually excavate these burrows in the ground. And the males guard the entrances to these burrows, and they have big teeth-like spines on their legs, and they lock themselves, they brace themselves against the tunnel walls and try to prevent rival males from getting into the tunnels where the females are. The females... These are amazing insects because they have elaborate parental care behaviors. The females will take pieces of the dung down into the burrows and chew them up with their mouth parts and process them and pack them together into these sort of balls, these little sausages of buried dung underground. And then she'll excavate a chamber at the end of that and place an egg in there. And that's essentially the full food resource, like an aliquot of food for each one of her offspring. And she'll do that, lay an egg and then close in the tunnel and then build another one of these balls and then close the tunnel. And we've watched these beetles do this. The females will make 50, 100 different trips down into the ground for every single one of these eggs that she lays. And during this time, the male is guarding that tunnel, keeping everybody else away, and mating with the female absolutely as often as he possibly can. And other males come and challenge. And the fights take place inside these tunnels. And they scramble and they push and they pry and they twist. And we tried forever to figure out how it is exactly that they use these horns. Because we wanted to know, why would one species have a straight horn and another species have a curved horn and another species have a branched horn? And we were assuming that we'd be able to pick up intricacies in the nature of these fights that would tell us why one species had one shape or another. And we failed. The fights are just chaos. We filmed hundreds of them. And they're amazing things to watch. But there's nothing predictable or repeatable about them except the outcome. Somehow or other, bracing and twisting and prying and pushing and pulling and trying to get the other beetle out of the tunnel, somehow at the end of the day, the male that has the longest horns and or the largest body sizes typically is the one who wins. And the smaller males get pushed out of the tunnels and leave and go find another tunnel and try to push their way into that.
So they just use these horns to bash away at their competition?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it bash. I would say they more use the horns to block the tunnel. You've got essentially a round or an egg-shaped animal blocking a tunnel, and they're very strong. So you have a rival pushing itself past, and it seems that the horns, regardless of what precise shape they take, seem to function like bars of a jail cell. They sort of block, they make it easier for a male inside the tunnel to block it so that another male can't push past. But it's not as simple as that because they don't sit still. They twist and push and pry. But they don't stab with them. They aren't able to puncture the armor of the rival males, so they don't actually get injured in this process. And they don't really bash each other either, but they definitely spar and twist, sort of strength contests, I suppose. But there's a twist to this story, too.
Yeah.
Which is that the biggest males have the biggest weapons, and these are the ones that are usually the most successful at guarding that tunnel and at mating with the female inside the tunnel. But there's small males in these populations, too. And they don't produce the horns. And so these small males look much more similar to a female. They don't have the big antlers or the big weapons, and they don't fight over the tunnels either. They have a sneak tactic, a satellite tactic. What'll happen is they'll work their way into a tunnel and try to stay there, but they get kicked out right away by bigger males. And instead of going from tunnel to tunnel to tunnel to keep trying, they stay after they get kicked out, and they dig their own tunnel right next to the main tunnel. And after they get sort of a centimeter or so down below the ground, they cut horizontally and they can intercept the guarded tunnel beneath the guarding male. And sometimes they're able to sneak in, zoom down to the female, mate with the female, and get out again before the guarding male has essentially figured out what's going on. So you've got big males with weapons fighting and little tiny sneak males without the weapons sneaking into these tunnels on the sly.
So the less macho, dung beetles still find a way.
They try. I don't think that they're as successful as the larger dominant males, but yes, they definitely find a way.
Can you see the armor and the weapons with your naked eye?
Yes, but I've had some practice. I think the first thing, if somebody were to go out and look for this in their backyard, which is the other fun thing about this system, is that these beetles live in so many different habitats in so many places that you'd be pretty hard-pressed to live anywhere where you couldn't go into a pasture or into the backyard and turn over a cow manure pile and look underneath it and find some of these beetles. They're that abundant and that widespread. So if you were to go out and look for these things yourself and tip over a cow pile and look at the dirt, maybe dig with a trowel into the first couple inches of the soil and turn it around, you'd find these beetles. They're often in most habitats, certainly around most places in the U.S., they would be on the order of half a centimeter to a centimeter long, and they're squat. The beetles that I'm talking about with the weapons walk like little tortoises. They've sort of jerked their way along. And you can pick them up and see the horns with the naked eye. We often look at them under microscopes to take more precise measurements of these things, and we photograph them either using really good camera lenses or sometimes scanning electron microscopes. We'll take really good pictures of these things as well. But you can definitely, for a lot of these beetles, pick them up out of the ground and look at them with a hand lens or with your naked eye and see these really cool weapons.
Now, you've described these like, you know, antler-like and branch-like weapons, you know, armor and weapons that the dung beetles have. And they sound like really big compared to the size of the actual beetles. Aren't they kind of cumbersome to tote around? I mean, I know they need them to fight and to bar off the tunnels and prevent other males from getting in, but they must also really get in the way.
They do. And so to try to give you a sense for how much they get in the way, the analogy I like to use is that for some of these beetles, it would be equivalent to you producing another leg and wearing it around on your head for your entire adult life.
Wow.
That's the best analogy I can give you, because if you try to estimate how big these things are, in some of these cases, the horn, the weapons, can be 10, 15, 20% of the body weight of the animal. It's a fifth of the total weight of the animal is allocated to this one thing. And so it really is analogous to an extra leg on your head for your entire adult life. And it has to be costly. So we've used a variety of types of experiments to try to measure how costly it is. And we found, for example, if a male beetle puts a ton of resources into making a horn, it means that he has to stunt something else. There's not enough resources left, in a sense. And so in some of these beetles, if they have really big horns, they have really small eyes. We found that in beetles that have horns on the back of their head, their eyes were 30% smaller as a result of having allocated everything to the weapons. In another species, they actually trade off with the testes or with the wings. So there are costs associated with producing these big, bulky things.
So what do these dung beetles say about evolution? What do you feel like you've learned about evolution from studying them?
Honestly, I'd have to turn that on its head and say, what haven't I learned about evolution from them? These beetles have taught us, and me in particular, an amazing amount of lessons, some good and some more frustrating. But the biggest question that I have been focusing on and that I think I've learned a ton from these beetles on has to do with the backdrop of animal diversity. It's very hard to be an evolutionary biologist and not look around you and become sort of increasingly aware of the differences among animals that are out there. There's so much variation in the way things act, the way they look, and it is sort of amplified in a way in these beetles. The variation in shape, especially connected with these weapons, is truly stunning in this group of beetles. And so as a biologist, I'm obsessed with understanding where this diversity in form comes from. How did these big, gaudy structures arise? Meaning, what do the beetles use these for? How are, you know, once we know how they're used in natural populations, we can ask questions like, how did they evolve? Under what types of ecological or environmental circumstances are these weapons likely to evolve? And then that leads us to the next question of, why don't all these beetles have the same weapons? What is it about them or about their history or the ecologies and behaviors of these animals in the past that has caused weapon evolution to go one way in some populations and a different way in other populations, and for it to go in enough different ways in enough different species that we end up with the truly thousands of types of shapes and forms and locations for these weapons on their bodies? And so there's sort of fundamental biological questions connected with animal diversity that we are tackling with these beetles.
Although we've been talking about dung beetles and the kind of weapons yep. that they have, you also study the rhino beetle, which is a much larger beetle. Let me read something from Wikipedia, and you could tell me if this is all true.
Okay.
We looked it up, and it says that
good for you.
Rhino beetles are among the largest of beetles. They are popular pets in Asia. They are clean, easy to maintain, and safe to handle. Male beetles are used for gambling fights since they naturally compete for female beetles, with a winner knocking the other off a log. And they're also the strongest animals on the planet in relation to their own size. They can lift up to 850 times their own weight. All true?
I believe so. The last statistic I don't have personal experience with, and I might argue that the dung beetles are actually stronger than the rhino beetles. But the rest of that is definitely true, and I'm actually holding a giant rhinoceros beetle in my hand right now.
Yikes, I wish I could see
it. Crawling up my arm.
Oh, gosh. You're in a studio in Montana, and I'm in a studio in Philadelphia, so we're not seeing each other, but I wish I could see that rhino beetle. Tell me what it looks like.
I will describe it to you. This male is about almost 4 inches long, and he's a rich
wow, it's big.
Brown, almost a purplish to brown to almost black color with a nice sheen to it and sort of golden hairs along the margins of his body.
Oh.
And the most striking feature of him, surprise, surprise, given what we've been talking about, is that on his head, he has an enormous horn. This is a big branch structure that actually looks surprisingly like a pitchfork that extends upwards from his head. And in the biggest of these males, that pitchfork, that weapon, can be almost as long as the rest of the body of these males. He also has another horn that's on the shoulder blades, the thorax, that comes up and curls a little bit forward and splits into two tips. But the horn that we're most excited about is this huge projection from the male's head that, if I'm sitting here looking at the head and the eyes, the horn is probably 10 times the length of the male's head, and it comes up and splits into a Y, and then each of the tips of the Y split again so that you have these four points or tines at the teeth of this horn.
Wow. I just wish
that's
I was.
That's just the horn. The
I just wish
like
I was seeing
long.
It. Wow. So
they prickle as they climb up your hands. Same idea as with the dung beetles. They've got teeth or points on their legs that they use to brace themselves in contests, and spines on the legs that they do the same thing with. And when they grab you, they can prick you a little bit with the spines. But otherwise, they're completely harmless. They feed as adults on rotting fruit. We keep them on apples, and basically sliced apples is what they'll quite happily feed on as adults. And they wouldn't be capable of biting you even if you tried to get them to. And they are kept as pets. Not here. This is a species that we import with permits from the United States Department of Agriculture, and we have to keep contained. But in Asia, where these things are native, they're very common pets. In fact, I'm told that you can buy the larvae in vending machines, and you can get the diet for these things in grocery stores. And kids really do keep them as pets. They're fantastic pets. And they do fight with them. They put them on bamboo sticks and battle the males. And I believe, gamble on which of the males will win. I haven't actually done that firsthand, but I've seen plenty of photographs of kids doing that.
It sounds like the cockfighting of the insect world.
I think it is.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Who knew that dung beetles living beneath animal manure could be so fascinating? Let's get back to our interview with Doug Emlin, a biology professor at the University of Montana, who's an expert on the evolution and development of bizarre or extreme shapes in insects. He's particularly interested in insect weaponry. And dung beetles have what he's looking for. The males are armed with bizarre-looking horns, which they use to fight over female beetles. If you want to see what we're talking about, go to our website, freshair.npr.org, where you'll find a dung beetle slideshow and a video of two beetles fighting. One of the things that amazes me, I guess, particularly about the smaller dung beetles, is that there's this, like, invisible world, this world that you don't know, that at least I don't know, is out there in which, you know, insects are like waging war with weapons and armor and competing.
And sneak tactics.
And sneak tactics. Yeah. All like, you know, for the love of a good woman. Or like, you know, to mate with the female. So there's this whole world of like sex and violence, you know, that's kind of invisible to us and is even happening underneath like cow manure.
I love that fact about these beetles, actually. That's one of my favorite things about them, is that this whole story is unfolding in most people's backyard. So just to give you a feel, the one genus of the dung beetles that we work on, so one sort of taxonomic grouping of these beetles, there are 2,000 species already described.
Wow.
Probably another 1,000 species waiting to be described. The center of diversity for that group of beetles is Africa, but they occur on all continents except Antarctica, and they feed on just about any kind of dung you can imagine. I mean, pretty much if you can think of an animal that produces a decent, respectable quantity of manure, there almost certainly is a beetle in this particular genus somewhere that is specialized on feeding on it. So these battles really do happen everywhere, in every habitat I've ever seen, on every continent or country that I've ever been to. And it's the same basic story. The weapons are different. Sometimes they're on one part of the body, sometimes on another, sometimes they're branched, sometimes they're curved. But the story is basically the same. They dig these tunnels under the ground. It could be rabbit dung or deer dung or elephant dung or giraffe dung or cow manure. But the beetles are still going to fly into the food source. They're still going to dig a tunnel into the ground underneath. The males are probably still going to fight over the entrance to that tunnel. I'll be willing to bet you there's small sneak males that are still going to try to get into that tunnel on the sly. And you have this whole interesting, dynamic, rich behavioral system taking place underground in every one of these habitats, on every one of these types of food sources.
Tell us about one of your greatest adventures searching for dung beetles around the world.
Sure. There actually are a number. You wouldn't think that collecting dung beetles would be that adventurous, but the truth might surprise you. So we have taken dugout canoes into the lowland forests of Ecuador searching for beetles, and we've sloshed through flooded pastures with leeches and wallabies in Australia. But the most common source of sort of danger or adventure collecting beetles is actually bulls. And if you can imagine, we spend a lot of time in cow pastures. Well, there's a lot of bulls in these pastures. And I think I can say that I have been charged full out by bulls on 5 different continents now and treed by them on 3. So we even had one time where I was charged by a Cape buffalo in Africa. We had permits to collect beetles in the Serengeti, and they don't normally like you to get out of your vehicles in the Serengeti, but in this case, they were willing to help us to try to get the beetles, and we had armed guards standing on the roofs of the vehicles spotting for us to make sure that the Cape buffalo didn't get too close, and we were out there diligently poking away and trying to find the beetles in the Serengeti, and they were calling out the distances, 100 meters, 90 meters, 80 meters, 70, 50, run, and they would tell us, and we would grab everything and leap back into the vehicle and get past there without getting charged by the Cape buffalo too close for comfort. But yeah, that was probably the most hair-raising opportunity to collect beetles.
Do the guards think you're kind of crazy taking risks like this to collect dung beetles?
They do, I have to say. That's one of the pleasant side effects of this type of an occupation, is that I often have to go out into places and introduce myself to complete strangers to ask permission to collect on their land, or in this case, to ask the guards if they'd be willing to help us collect in the Serengeti. And they always want to sit down and talk to you about where you're from and what you do, and you meet some wonderful people that way. But I think more than a few of them thought we were a little bit nuts.
So you have traveled around the world collecting dung beetles. Have you ever been surrounded by more dung beetles than you cared to?
Yes, and that would definitely have been in Africa. There is no place quite like Africa for dung beetles. And we'd heard about the numbers of beetles that you can encounter, but until I actually saw it firsthand, it was pretty hard to imagine. So it was actually the same trip in the Serengeti where we had the armed guards and we were trying not to get charged by the Cape buffalo. We happened across elephant dung in the road, and I realized normal people don't do this, but we hopped out of the car and collected the elephant dung in a Tupperware bin and brought it back to the campground where we were staying that evening. And I remember with a bunch of the students, we all had headlights on, and we set out to the edge of camp and placed the elephant dung out on the ground to see what we could find. And I sat there with my clipboard trying to take notes on the beetles that came in, and the beetles started coming in faster and faster and faster, and pretty quickly it was impossible to see anything because they were all buzzing and circling around our headlights. And then a couple minutes later, they were starting to pour out of the sky so fast that I couldn't even take notes on my clipboard because my clipboard was covered with literally an inch of solid beetles. They were going down our necks, they were in our hair, they were in our faces. And finally, by the end, this sounds like an exaggeration, but it's not. It was as if somebody stood over us with a bucket full of beetles and poured it steadily out on top of us. The beetles absolutely covered the elephant dung. Tens to probably hundreds of thousands of them came within minutes, and we were utterly overwhelmed.
So different dung beetles feed on different kinds of dung. Now, I understand in Australia, they actually had to import a certain kind of dung beetle because they needed it, and there weren't any anymore or weren't enough?
That's true. So Australia has an interesting and rich native fauna of dung beetles. So there's a number of native species that are there, many of which have really cool horns, incidentally. But the problem that Australia had was that when they clear-cut a lot of the forests to create space for cattle, which was an important part of the economic development of Australia, it turned out that all of the native dung beetle species were specialists of forests. And none of their native species would cross that barrier and sort of move from the woods out into the open. And from a beetle's perspective, out in the open in the sun in a pasture is a very, very different environment than in the shade of a forest. And so they had this problem of tons and tons of cattle and just obscene amounts of cow manure and no native beetles that were burying it. And so I've seen photographs of pastures in Australia that are literally cowpat to cowpat to cowpat as far as the eye can see, just nonstop. And what happened is they started getting flies that were sort of pest flies that went ballistic in this food source and were driving everybody crazy. And so Australia did a really good job of researching this problem. They went to Africa and to Europe and they researched dung beetle species and found species that only lived in pastures. And they had this test. I mean, they basically tried to only find species that would not go into the woods. They would stay only in the pastures. And they picked these species and they bred them in captivity, and then they had to do all these sort of quarantine procedures to bring them into Australia. And then they bred them in captivity in Australia, and they did controlled releases of these beetles. And it's been a success. They now have a number of species that are very well established that bury the dung in pasture habitats. And because they went to that extra step of incorporating the biology of these beetles and finding species that didn't go into the woods, the introduced species have not, as far as I know, replaced or driven extinct any of the native species.
Now, you've described how dung beetles live, you know, largely underneath dung patties, but don't some dung beetles actually live on the butts of animals?
Yes. So, again, the dung beetles have diversified incredibly, and part of that diversity has to do with specializing on different types of dung or different types of food. And there are beetles in the same genus, the same group that we've talked about, the 2,000 species worldwide, there are species that have been described that are specialists for either koala dung or sloth dung. And in these cases, these are animals that move very slowly and they bury their dung. They'll climb down to the bottom of a tree and dig a hole and bury their dung underground. If you can be at the right place at the right time, that's fantastic. It's a great way to have your food, have it buried on top of you, and have all your eggs develop without any competition because nobody else finds it. And so what these beetles do is they actually ride around on the animals, and they have specialized hooks on their legs that help them cling to the fur. And they cling basically near the rear end of these animals, and they ride with the koala or with the sloth. And when these animals go to the bathroom, they hop off, go lay their eggs, and climb back on again and wait for the next time. So it is true. Dung beetles do some pretty amazing things.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Doug Emlin, and we're talking about his work as a biologist who studies dung beetles. And he studies dung beetles because they have bizarre forms, because they have armor. They have horns and antlers and all kinds of surprising things. My impression of the beetles that you study, based on the enlarged photos that I've seen, is that they look really prehistoric because of the antlers and the armor and the pincers and the horns, all of the assorted weaponry. Are they prehistoric? Do they date back to the same era as the dinosaurs?
They do. There's reasonably – well, so if you use the types of tools I alluded to a little while ago to reconstruct the history of these beetles, there are a number of studies now that have come up with pretty solid dates for how old these groups of animals are. So the dung beetles that we talked about so far, we spent most of our time talking about, the group of dung beetles that I said had 2,000 species in it, that genus or that group of beetles we think dates back about 40 million years. But that group of dung beetles is related to other dung beetles that date back further than that. And those beetles shared a common ancestor with the rhinoceros beetles maybe 150 million years ago. And so we definitely are talking about groups of these horned beetles that go back as far as the dinosaurs. And there's fairly compelling evidence that there were dung beetles back then, in the sense that there are fossil coprolites or scat from dinosaurs that have burrows in them that resemble the burrows that we see made by present-day dung beetles. So it's circumstantial evidence at the moment, but the histories that we reconstruct using molecular evidence or using the sequences of DNA also suggest that these lineages of beetles go back that far. So yes, I'd be willing to bet that there were beetles digging around underneath the dung of Tyrannosaurus rex or many of the other dinosaurs, the ceratopsids, for example, which also have really cool weapons, like Triceratops and Styracosaurus. I'll bet you there were dung beetles crawling around under there. And I'll bet you the beetles had horns, too. They probably did something not too different from what they do in people's backyards today. Dug tunnels into the ground and fought over those tunnels with their weapons.
So you've studied these beetles, and they're really fascinating. How tolerant are you of insects that we regard as pests? Like if you have ants or cockroaches that you find in your home, are you going to be fascinated by them? Or do you want to just get rid of them as soon as possible?
Here's where I'm going to get in trouble with the pesticide industry. I actually would never spray for those things in my house, because teaching entomology has taught me a great deal about the neurological and carcinogenic side effects of many of the things that we use to kill insects. So the answer is I love just about all kinds of insects, although cockroaches are an interesting one. Even most of the entomologists I know don't like cockroaches, although they have amazing diversity in their parental care behavior. There's species where they carry the young around on their backs. There's species of cockroaches that have the equivalent of a pregnancy. They actually will nurse their young, their eggs, inside their bodies until they hatch. So it's a long developmental period inside their bodies. And then when they hatch, they have glands on their body that they feed these young with, which is just like nursing in humans. So cockroaches do some interesting things. And no, I don't kill cockroaches. There are a few types of spiders that I will squash with a paper towel. And that's only because there's a chance that they have a necrotic bite, a dangerous bite. And we've got young kids, and I don't take that chance. So if it looks like a hobo spider, I'll squash it. Otherwise, everything else in our house lives.
So let me ask you, you said that, you know, entomologists who study insects are more negative about cockroaches than other insects, and even entomologists don't like cockroaches. I certainly empathize.
I'm going to get in trouble
they
for
have
saying
my,
that.
They have my full support
I'm sure
in this.
There are exceptions
but,
to everything.
But,
like
but why do you think that even entomologists don't like cockroaches?
I shouldn't have said that. I'm already going to regret it. But I know several entomologists that have not liked cockroaches. For one thing, many, many people are allergic to cockroaches. They have basically cockroaches developing in your house or in a building shed their cuticle, their skeleton, and their skin as they molt, as they grow. And they also have frass or feces that they produce. And these have chemical residues on them that many, many people are allergic to. And, I mean, I hate to say this on record, but you'd be hard-pressed to find any building probably in this country that's not infested with cockroaches at some level or another. Certainly all public buildings, it's impossible to keep these things completely gone. And what happens is then the shed pieces of cuticle and frass get picked up in the air duct systems of these buildings and dispersed around the buildings. And a lot of people suspect now that that may be a major trigger for asthma. one of the causes of asthma because so many people are allergic to or sensitive to cockroaches. I can tell you an anecdotal story about that if you like.
Please.
Sort of, do you? Okay. It was peripheral to what we've been talking about. But when I was an undergraduate, I was hugely influenced by a professor of mine, a biologist and entomologist named George Eichwort, one of the greatest entomologists I ever met. And I remember driving across the country with him when I was a college undergraduate. He was an advisor to me. I was doing research out at a place called the Rocky Mountain Lab in Colorado. And we had to keep going way out of our way. This was in the late 80s. This was before there was a Starbucks on every corner and you can get really good coffee. And he was fiercely addicted to caffeine, to coffee. And we'd have to drive way off the interstate to go find good coffee in that day. I mean, we'd go 45 minutes off our route to go find a place that had whole bean, fresh ground coffee. And I remember giving him a really hard time because we were wasting a lot of travel time trying to feed his addiction because he needed coffee every couple hours. And he finally explained to me he had to drink only sort of whole bean, fresh ground coffee. And it was because of cockroaches. There's a point to this story, which is that he found out the hard way from teaching entomology year after year after year, handling cockroaches. People use cockroaches as the lab rat for entomology labs. He got really badly allergic to them, so he couldn't even touch cockroaches without getting an allergic reaction. And because of that, he couldn't drink pre-ground coffee. And it turned out when he looked into it that pre-ground, you know, your big bulk coffee that you buy in a tin, is all processed from these huge stockpiles of coffee, these piles of coffee that get infested with cockroaches, and there's really nothing they can do to filter that out. So it all gets ground up in the coffee. And he was actually allergic to pre-ground coffee because of that sort of spin-off from having handled him teaching entomology for all those years.
Oh, so. I don't know what to say. Thank you for that marvelous
You may not want
insight.
To put that on the air, but for better or worse.
Oh, that's really upsetting.
That is a true story. That, according to this professor and how he related to me, and we wasted many, many hours trying to find basically fresh ground whole bean coffee so that he didn't have to have an allergic reaction to the pre-ground.
Is there any other evidence besides this one person that there's...
Oh, there is.
Yeah.
This isn't my forte, but I looked into it a little bit because I tell that story in my entomology classes. Technically speaking, if I'm not mistaken, the FDA regulates the percent by dry weight of foodstuffs like this that can be ground insect parts to make sure that it doesn't end up being too much of the total.
Thank you.
And it's a trace amount. Chocolate, incidentally, is the other one that if you think of as huge piles of beans, of cocoa beans all piled up, that then gets ground up into something we all love and eat.
I'm glad I asked. Okay. well, Doug Emlen, thank you so much for talking with us about the beetles that you've been studying.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure too.
Doug Emlen is a biology professor at the University of Montana. You can find a slideshow of dung beetles and video of two beetles in combat on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Detroit in the late 1960s was a hotbed of talent, from the rock groups playing the Grandy Ballroom to the soul talent vying for a deal with Motown to numerous jazz groups at lounges all over town. But when Motown moved to California in 1971, all of this talent was left with nowhere to record. Today, Ed Ward tells the story of Westbound Records, which, in its eccentric way, did its best to document black music as it changed in Detroit.
Carmen Baladian was driving westbound on 8 Mile Road one day in 1968 when the name came to him. Ever since he'd been a high school student, he'd been making records, but now he was going to get serious and keep a label going, and Westbound just felt right. Now he could put a name on the records by the group he was sure was going to turn things upside down. Funkadelic was the band behind the Parliaments, a vocal group signed to Revolo, a label that was in severe financial trouble. The Parliaments' leader, George Clinton, was restless. The songs he'd been selling to Motown didn't get cut, and he had ideas he wanted to record. So he signed Funkadelic to Baladian, and sure enough, in time, they had a hit.
I
I Bet You was only a top 20 soul hit, but it was so unlike the other music coming out of Detroit that it attracted the right people. Funkadelic wouldn't be a hit-making machine for another 10 years, but meanwhile, their albums on Westbound were staples in the dorm rooms of hip black college students. One thing Baladian knew was that radio people could help you find a hit, and he was lucky to have a good working relationship with Martha Jean the Queen Steinberg, program director of CKLW in Windsor, Ontario, across the river from Detroit. Martha Jean was from a distinguished black Memphis music family. Her brother Louis had been Booker T and the MG's first bassist. And in 1971, she told Baladian that Willie Mitchell, a Memphis bandleader, was becoming a producer and needed a label. One listen to the master Mitchell was trying to sell convinced him, and Denise LaSalle gave Westbound its first number one record.
Somebody tell me, what is this man got? What I don't want to feel. Somebody tell me, what is this man got? He makes me give what I don't want to give. On solid ground, I feel myself sinking fast. I grab a hold, but I don't think it's gonna last. I'm slowly losing my ground, slowly sinking down, trapped.
The record made Willie Mitchell enough for him to get to work in the studio with a young singer he'd discovered named Al Green. Westbound was smart to look out of town for talent. It was something few regional labels did. Dayton, Ohio isn't far from Detroit, but far enough that the Ohio Untouchables, a band based there, knew they were being overlooked. Changing their name to the Ohio Players, they mixed blues, gospel, and a new kind of music being championed by Sly Stone and James Brown called funk. Westbound knew about funk and signed them. Pain wasn't a huge hit, and the Players' biggest success would come later on Mercury, but once again, Westbound showed its experimental bent. The biggest innovation for the label caught it by surprise. The Detroit Emeralds were a standard three-piece vocal group with a decent track record for the label when they released this record in 1972.
See how I'm walking, see how I'm talking, no.
Didn't get a lot of airplay, but it suddenly started selling like crazy, particularly in Boston, where it had caught fire in a new institution, gay discotheques. A producer named Tom Moulton had done an unauthorized remix, extending the song's length, and now Westbound found itself in the disco business, with hits by Dennis Coffey and CJ and Company following over the years. One of the most remarkable records Westbound issued in the mid-70s was a failure, but not because of its quality.
Alvin wasn't out of me, man. Before he was running wild, as far as we could see back, he was always a problem child. They say Alvin was born and raised, he was raised from a bad, bad seed.
Alvin Stone by the Fantastic Four was nothing more or less than a rock opera crammed into 6 minutes and 46 seconds, telling of the rise and fall of a black gangster. It was way ahead of its time and makes fascinating listening today. Besides disco, another thing that had kept Westbound afloat was gospel music, and that's where it got its last national hit in 1983.
You brought the sunshine.
Clark Sisters were part of a Detroit gospel family that went back to the 1930s, and the danceable rhythm of You Brought the Sunshine made it a huge club hit. Times had certainly changed since that drive down 8 Mile, and Baladian pulled back from the national scene, content to record gospel and license reissues of his back catalog, which he continues to do today.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France. All the music he played is collected on the CD, The Original 8 Mile, Westbound Records 40th Anniversary, on Ace Records.